many things I wish to say. As she spoke, I watched you squirm in your seat. Each time you parted your lips, your eyes fell on my bandages, and you fell silent. When your mother left, so did you. Urgent business, she said, that the both of you had to attend to. I watched you go. You looked back at me as you walked out of the room. And then I sat up. I watched the moon rise. I thought of the tiger somewhere in the castle, rotting. What was I going to do with it? I'd never heard of anyone eating a tiger. An old Corum poem came to mind. The Carse's daughter has tiger-striped arms. I could not remember the rest. I racked my brains for it, but I might have been milking a stallion for all the good it did me. Eventually, my frustration surrendered to exhaustion. I fell asleep and dreamed of the steps. At least until you crept into bed next to me. Still half asleep, I thought I must have dreamed you. Your hair unbound. Your skin flushed with anger or embarrassment or... Shefali, you said, lying next to me. How small you were for an 8-year-old. How tall I was. I'm sorry. I must have been dreaming. I should have moved faster. I must have been dreaming. Those words would never leave you in the waking world. I won't let it happen again. Sleep, then. I went to court more than once. I did not like it. There in the halls of jade, I was stared at by scholars and advisors and sycophants. Ah, oh, she's a cochon, they might say when they saw you. They'd bow so low that their beards swiped against the ground. The tiger slayer! Heaven's blood runs pure in you. I did not kill the tiger, you'd say. You said this each time we went to court, at least 5 times. I struck the last blow, but I did not kill it. Do not be so modest, they might say, or your humility is an inspiration. With a sharp gesture, you'd wave them away. Under your breath, you would mutter curses at them. A bit louder, you would apologize to me on their behalf. But me? Oh, Shiro-san, they might say, if they were being charitable. Yun was far more common for them than son, as if I possessed a traitor's cunning simply for being born darker than they were. Your father is a fine man, and your brother fares well. But these courtiers never seemed to have any words for me. Nothing for Shefali, no praise. Did they know my name? Was I simply Oshiro to them? I must be. Not once during those summer months did I hear my personal name, say from your family. And that honorific, son. I do not pretend to understand Hokkaran honorifics. Some things are beyond explanation. My people have 20 different words for the color brown, most of which relate to the color of a horse's coat. Your people have 8 sets of 4 honorifics, 1 for each god. Using the wrong one in the wrong context was as bad as spitting in the eye of a person's mother right in front of them. To make matters worse, half of them sounded the same. I knew only a few. Son was the lowest form of the grandmother's honorific. Depending on the person speaking it, it might be affectionate. Most of the time, however, it indicated that the speaker thought themselves far above the subject. The other ones I knew were more, which was the highest for the mother. Lore, the second highest for the sister and your father's favorite, Tono, used for the emperor alone, and Shun. Shun was the daughter's highest. Who was better to wear it than the girl born on the 8th day of the 8th month of the 8th year at the last bell? You are doomed to be Shizuka-shun all your life, as I am destined to be Barsalai Su for all of mine. Honorifics were the least of our concerns, however. If we were annoyed by them, that meant we were at court. And if we were at court, there were other matters to distract us. Court itself, for instance. I had no clothes to wear. Your father was kind enough to buy me a new dress, for I was too tall to use any of yours. It was not so bad for a Hokkaran dress, green with painted horses along the sleeves and hem. There was the matter of etiquette, of which I knew little. I solved that problem by letting you do all the talking and bowing only when you glanced toward me expectantly. And though it involved me little, there was also the matter of what people were saying. As a space between a hammer and a pot, that was the court in those days. Emperor Yoshimoto could do little to stop the worries faced by his people.
"We will increase patrols along the Wall of Flowers," he said.
2 weeks later, those patrols were found mangled and broken just outside the wall.
"We will consult the oracles," he said.
When the Hokkaran oracle was brought in to read the future in her vapors, she frothed at the mouth, screamed and died on the gilded floor. And then came Yoshimoto's famous motto,
"We will endure."
It became something of a saying among the peasants. A farmer struck his hoe against the ground, a new hoe he had made himself with fresh wood not a week ago. Sure enough, it would splinter. He'd pick up the metal end and heft it high overhead. After getting his wife's attention, he would grin a sad, gap-toothed grin. "We will endure," he'd say. A fisherman strikes out to sea. He takes with him a good net and a good rod. He sails far out and casts his net. Soon it is filled with pink salmon, flopping about, taking their last breaths. Just as he closes his eyes to thank the kami for his bounty, he smells something off. He opens his eyes. The fish are rotten.
"We will endure,"
is his bitter laugh. Already the words began to haunt us. Not long after I started healing, your mother left for another one of her missions. The magistrates out in Shiratori were having issues with the rebellion. They'd already caught the leader, but wanted your mother to make an example of him for the crowd. She did not look happy when she left, although your father managed to make her smile, whispering some secret promise in her ear. Your father sat at the head of the dinner table and spoke blessings over our food. He teased you constantly. In his easy way, he would smile and call you the most red woman in Fujino.
"After all," he said, "your notices hang on every door. Your poetry is clear and simple, as refreshing as spring water."
"Father," you'd say, scrunching up your face, as if you'd tasted something sour, "they are your brother's words. For yes, your uncle forced you to write all his notices. We will endure, 800 times each morning."
"Ah, yes," Itsuki said.
He held his teacup beneath his nose. Its sweet aromas filled his lungs and lent his smile a warmer air.
"But your brushstrokes are the poetry."
You palmed your face and I laughed. Oitsuki watched you with a bemused look. This was how he always was, calm and relaxed, somehow above stress or worry. I cannot remember a wrinkle crossing his face, save for the lines winging his eyes when he laughed, and he laughed often. Whenever he and Shizuru attended court, he could not contain himself, always a twinkle in his eye, always some unheard joke rolling around his mind. Many nights we passed like that, speaking with your father. The jokes were a welcome change from his brother's proclamations. That was the year your uncle announced the Eightfold Path to Plenty. All farmers had to bury specific stones attuned to their patron god in their fields, one every li in each direction. For farms less than a li square, 8 idols had to be buried, each 1/8 of the distance apart. A superstitious gesture at best, meant to play on current fears. Your uncle claimed that it was Hokkara's lack of faith that prompted the heavenly family's abandonment. Only proper veneration would bring them back. Anyone who failed to perform their pious duties would face imperial justice. Of course, burying things in a field like that, planting things the way he said to plant them, following all those rules. I am no farmer, Shizuka. When I die and you leave me out for the vultures, that is the closest I shall come to farming, for flowers will grow where I last lay. But even I saw starving commoners curse your uncle. Oh, when we were 8, it was not so bad. When we were 8, one could eke out a living, just barely. But do you remember, Shizuka, when we traveled after? I am getting ahead of myself. That part too will come. I had my own set of rooms in Fujino, but that did not stop me from visiting yours. I slept in my own bed perhaps twice in the entire 3 seasons I was with you. In the dark of night, when the moon was high, I worked on my project. I had the tiger's pelt brought up to me. With my clumsy hands, I sewed and cut and sewed and cut. The end result was not going to be impressive, but it would be mine. My mother arrived on the 22nd of Tsushao. With her came about a third of the Burkila clan, including two of my aunts. And Otgar, of course. I suspect that she would have come even if she was in the sands at the time. I met them at the gates on my horse. Otgar came riding up next to my mother. In the absence of my brother, she was a capable interpreter. All that time spent in Argair clued her into my mother's language of gestures. "Needlenose," she shouted in Khorne. "You live. I heard a tiger ate you." You blinked. You sat on your horse next to me. I do not think you'd seen other Khorne before, or at least, not so many. Otgar's loud, long greeting, several times longer in Khorne than it would have been in Hokarin, might have startled you. I waved at her as she pulled in. She clapped me hard on the shoulder and mussed my hair. A little over a year had been since I saw her, yet in that time she'd grown into her body far more than I had. Seeing her wide face, her red cheeks, her beautifully embroidered deal, made me feel more at home already. Then she took me close and pressed her nose against my cheek. She recoiled. "You smell like flowers." I laughed and pointed to you. You drew back. "What is the matter?" you said. "Why was that girl smelling you?" "To make sure she is the same Shifali," Otgar said. Time lightened her Hokarin accent. She almost sounded native. "Smell never changes, no matter how long she is with pale foreigners." "Something changed in your posture. You speak Hokarin," you said. "I do," she said. "I am Dorbente Otgar Bayasak, and it is my honor to serve as Burkila's interpreter." Next to us, our mothers exchanged their customary greetings. Despite the crowd, my mother embraced yours, held her tight, with fingers in Oshizuru's hair. But I was more concerned with what Otgar had said. "Dorbente," I repeated. "You are an adult?" Otgar beamed from ear to notch ear, proudly displaying her missing tooth. "I am," she said, "when I learn to speak Syrian. No braids yet, but soon." "I am Oshizuka," you said, though no one had asked. "Daughter of Oitsuki and Oshizuru, imperial niece, blood of heaven." "Yes, yes," said Otgar, waving you off. "You are Barsatak. We know of you already. We have heard the stories." I tilted my head. Barsatak, an adult name like Dorbente. But where Dorbente meant possessing three, Barsatak meant, well, it meant tiger thief. I'm sorry you had to find out this way. "So, you've discussed me," you said. Color filled your cheeks, and something of your old demeanor returned. "Yes. Yes, I am Barsatak Shizuka." I covered my mouth rather than laugh. Tiger thief. My clan bestowed upon you the great honor of an adult name, something only a handful of foreigners received. And they named you Tiger Thief. You were so quick to embrace it. Someone must have told you what a mark of acceptance it is to be named by the Khorne, and yet, Tiger Thief. I was safe from hiding my amusement when my mother rode over. As animals sense storms, so I sensed her coming, and all the mirth fell from my face. My mother's eyes were vipers, her quick gestures as fangs in my flesh. Otgar, too, lost her mirth. "Shefali," she said. "Burkila is displeased that you would act in such a foolhardy fashion." "She is your daughter, Alshara," said Oshizuru. "You are lucky she did not stuff the tiger with fireworks and set it soaring through the sky." Alshara shook her head. Another series of gestures, though less sharp. "Burkila will host a banquet tonight in her gair to celebrate her daughter's well-being," Otgar said. "You are all welcome." Good lamb stew, a warm fire with my clan sitting around it, my grandmother's nagging, my aunts beating more felt into the gare, my uncles trying to convince them to do other things instead. The acrid smell of the fire pit, strips of meat hanging just above it to cure, wind whistling outside, rattling the small red door. I'd get to see our hunting dogs again, too. How big were they now? The russet bitch must have had her pups. And the kumak. Grandma, the sky, the kumak. I bounced in my saddle the whole way to camp, no matter how upset my mother was. Home. I was going home again. When in dreams I go to you. Home for me means two things. The first is you. Above all, you are my white felt gear. You are my bright red door. And you are my warm fire. But if I cannot have you, then I will have silver. The silver of the steppe's swaying grass. The silver of winter. The silver clouds coloring grandmother's sky. In Fujino, you see, everything is green. One look outside your window will tell you why. Your imperial forest is so deep green that it reminds me of the father's ocean, and it is only one of many. Your province is covered in too many to name. Your father once called Fujino the land of sun and pine. He also called it the land of rolling hills. I hate hills, Shizuka. Did you know? You cannot build a gare on a hill. Everything will slide right off your furniture. You cannot camp at the bottom of a hill. The rain can get in and extinguish your fire. You cannot wrestle on a hill without your cousin tumbling down and cracking her head on a rock, as I learned when Otgar tossed me off one when we were 10. But I admit, there's more to it than my own opinion. The Sambartans tell us that you can find true peace only when sky and earth are mirrors of each other. That is when you encounter eternity. Standing at the base of the Rakon with Gurkhan Khalsar behind you, is there anything more infinite than that? That is, I think, my favorite spot in the whole world. And to think, I never got to show it to you. Well, as far as the hills go, and green, Oshiro is a far sight better than Fujino. Oshiro exists on the gentlest slope in the empire. What few trees mark the landscape are bright white or warm brown. The people are the same. In Fujino, it's my appearance that makes people stare. My hay-colored hair, my bowed legs, my skin so dark and cheeks so wide. In Oshiro, I see those features staring back at me on Hokkaran faces, a guard with flecks of green in his eyes, babies born with blue marks on their bottoms and cheeks meant for nibbling. Oshiro is not home. No, for it will always remind me of my father. But I love it when it reminds me of my mother. And there is the wall. You cannot discuss Oshiro without discussing the wreckage. The wall of stone was built 300 years ago, at the height of the Koran culture, when brave Arslender led us as Karsk. One of your ancestors decided the only way to keep us from raiding Oshiro and the border villages was to build a wall. But, you see, he did not build the wall simply to keep us out. He thought that such a feat of engineering would amaze us. He thought we would gaze upon it and weep. He thought we would cast aside our weapons and our horses and join the superior Hokkaran Empire. But what he did not know was this. Koran engineers exist. Koran stonemasons, Koran builders. Wherever we go, we welcome additions to the clan, should they prove stout enough to survive the winter. Those newcomers might not be Koran, but their children are. And so the trade is passed down the family line. This comes in handy when we encounter other travelers. We can offer services instead of just goods. More than once, we've stopped near a Syrian town and helped construct a house or two. More than once, we've offered medical assistance to the desert nomads. More than once, we've been contacted by Shini scholars for our thoughts on astronomic conundrums. That is why the remains of the wall makes me smile. The wreckage reminds me of what a woman can do when she becomes an arrow in flight. Reminds me that we are so much more than what the Hokkarans think us to be. And if you stand in the right spot, the white palace at your back and the hole in the wall right in front of you, then you are almost eternal. Almost. Do you remember Shizuka, the feast that awaited us beyond the wall? Your parents huddled beneath a white felt roof, surrounded by carpets and tapestries. Chizuru pinched her nose with one hand. With the other, she held a skin full of kumak. My uncles challenged her to drink all of it in one go. She did, of course. Your mother was never one to refuse a drink or a dare. If she stepped out of the gare to vomit hours later, no one pointed it out. No one would dare. Your father drank more than she did, of course. 2.5 skins of kumak for him, and he did not have to hold his nose. But he did not draw attention to it. Only the red on his cheeks gave him away. The imperial poet could never allow himself to slur his words. Not that he did much speaking. Your father knew more Korn than his wife did, but I can't remember hearing him speak it. Our language reminded him of the war, I think, of the early days of his brother's reign. But he would never say such a thing out loud.
It had been many, many years since Oitzki spoke of the Korn War.
All the highest-ranking members of the Burkila clan attended. That night, I saw generals dance around the fire. I saw men and women the Hokarans painted as bloodthirsty barbarians tell body jokes. I ate and ate and ate, and I did it with my fingers instead of fumbling with chopsticks, and there was no rice to fall between my fingers, no fish bones to stab me in the tongue. There was soup and pickled sheep's head, and my cousin sat around the fire throwing ankle bones. You watched me. In between hugs from my clanmates, I caught sight of you. Flickering flames painted your amber eyes orange. And as Otgar whispered in my ear, as my mother kept a keen eye on her drunk siblings, I watched you. Among the dark-skinned, light-haired Korn you sat, pale and inky-haired. I remember you, or do I remember only the disguise all the kumak draped around you? For I thought to myself that you were so pale and so still, you must be a masked actress. At any moment your face would fall clean off to reveal your true nature, if only I kept watching. But you stared into the flames and squeezed your hands until your knuckles went white. And if the director called for you to shed your mask, you did not hear him. A man on the wall of stone spots riders coming. Wasting no time, he hefts his hammer and strikes the great iron bell. He did not think to cover his ears, and so for hours afterwards they ring. At night when he lies down to sleep, he hears it, feels it in his bones. He cannot escape the sound. So it was that when I looked at you, my chest rang with your discomfort. I reached out and touched your shoulder. You sniffed. "It is strange," you said, "to feel the way you do in Fujino. At least here no one looked at you as if you were going to murder them on a moment's notice. The first time someone gave me that look in Fujino, I was 10. But I knew what it was like, and I did my best to comfort you. Otgar is my best friend," I said. You stiffened. "Besides you," I added. This is why I did not like talking. I meant to imply that you two should talk. If I liked both of you, then you were bound to like each other. At the mention of her name, Otgar slid over to us. "Besides Barsatok," she said, "you wound me, needle nose. Too much time in one place. Your mind is getting stagnant." I chuckled, but you did not think it was funny. "Shefali's been staying with my family," you said. "We've the finest tutors in all of Hokkaido." I was afraid Otgard would roll her eyes at this. Instead, she laughed in a good-natured way. "Yes, Barsatok, of that I am sure," she said. "But we are Korn. Traveling is in our blood. You learn nothing staying in one place. Only by struggling against the earth do you learn anything of worth." "Is that how you learned your languages?" you said. "It is," Otgar said. "Burkila traveled the spice road to Shershar. On the way we met a Surian merchant, with no stores save those he meant to sell. Burkila allowed him to come with us on the condition she receive a portion of the money from whatever he sold. Except he spoke no Korn." "So you learned Surian," you said, "to translate for him." "No, my mother slept with him," said Otgar, "and he left some of his books behind when he left, so I cracked them open. I had to learn, you see, so I could translate for Burkila," Otgar corrected, waving her finger. "The Karsa is always the highest priority." Except that my mother never formally accepted the title of Karsa as part of the terms of her marriage. No one paid that any heed here. She was a Karsa in all but name. "You said nothing to this. For all your talent with Hokkaran, you spoke not a word of Korn. Oh, you could write it. My mother wanted our alphabet to be simple enough for a child to learn. You knew it, and you knew which symbols corresponded to which sounds. But the words themselves, the grammar... No, That you could not do. So you sat and you shifted. I imagine you were about to say something cutting when my mother raised her hand in the air, and the gear fell silent. Otgar rushed to her side. I sidled up closer to you. My mother was giving me that viper look again. Her serpents coiled about my heart and squeezed. She would not throw a celebration like this if she meant to tear into me in front of the clan, would she? My mother's fingers made shapes too fast for me to keep up with them. Before my stay with you, I knew a great many of her gestures, but now I found I could no longer keep up. It's a strange feeling being unable to understand your own mother. Rakila Ashara Nadiasara welcomes you all, Otgard said. Both those of her clan, and of Nasur and Shizaru's. I'd heard your mother's corn name before, but it had been some time. The sound of it startled me. Nay, for eight. Cern for trials. Eight trials, Shizaru. For the 8 days of hardship she and Al-Shahar endured past the Wall of Flowers. Looking at her rosy, drunk face now, it was hard to imagine her cutting down one of the traitor's generals. But then again, legend has it she learned the name of the general by charming one of his underlings, and your mother has always been a very charming drunk. I tried to picture it. My mother and yours huddled together in a damp prison cell, an unspeakable monstrosity dangling rotten food just out of their grasp. Your mother calling him closer and closer, beckoning with her husky voice. My mother grabbing the thing's arm and slamming it against the bars. One day we shall hear that story in full, Shizuka. I've heard tell that my brother wrote of it from a few of the nobles here. With that I would find a copy and have it read to me. Sky knows my mother refused to elaborate on what had happened. So much of it is left to our imaginations, Shizuka. And imaginations are the worst kinds of liars. But even so, it was hard to imagine you and I killed a tiger. She hopes you will enjoy the kumak to its fullest extent, and advises that anyone caught vomiting in her gear will be punished, Otgard continued, as she hates the smell. All eyes fell on your mother. The laughter that left her, unbridled and boisterous, was more corn than Hokarin. Don't give me that look, Al-Shara, she said. I outdrank Kikamorazul. I can keep this down. I am not certain if your mother knew the gravity of referring to my mother by her birth name. As a Hokarin man might only call his wife, daughter, and mother by their personal names, so a Korn would never think of addressing anyone but his immediate family by their child name. An adult name was earned. An adult name told you everything you needed to know about a person. My mother, for instance, is the destroyer for what she did to the Wall of Stone. And yet Shizuru called her the same thing my grandmother called her, the same thing I might call her if I wanted to catch a backhand. You will not tell my mother I've been using her personal name this whole time, will you? The Burkila chiefs stared at your mother. Some cleared their throats. None said a word against her. Such was our mother's friendship. Anyone who spoke up against Shizuru spoke up against Al-Shara. My mother shook her head. She made four more gestures, then pointed to the red door, a wry smile on her harsh face. Burkila says that you're welcome to vomit outside, Nisarin, as she knows you will, Otgar said in Hokarin. Your mother guffawed, slapped her knee. Itsuki covered his mouth. I had to remind myself that this was the Queen of Crows and the Imperial Poet laughing like children. I had to remind myself that your parents were far older than mine, and you were their only daughter. Was it lonely, Shizuka, growing up without a sibling? Kinshira was not always with me, and by then he had already left for Shanglai, but I had more cousins than I knew what to do with. I've only heard you mention yours once or twice. If only we did not live so far apart. I know my family is loud, and I know they stay up too late, and I know how fond you are of time alone. But I wish I could have kept you company. I wish we had spent more hours together than apart. Was that why you were so sour? Because I was leaving? My mother continued her gesturing. Now her movements were slow and deliberate. As she spoke, she made eye contact with everyone in the room, including me. At that moment, I wished I were a horse, so I might run away faster. But before the festivities can continue, there is one thing Burkila would like to say, said Otgar. You have all by now heard the story of Sheikh Ali and the tiger. It is her opinion that such a deed entitles Sheikh Ali to a proper adult name. My breath caught. Next to me, you sat dumbfounded. It occurred to me Otgar was speaking in Khorne, and you could not understand her. Mother beckoned me closer. I stood, reaching for the bundle of cloth behind me, and walked to her. From this day forth, said Otgar. My mother reached for a strand of my hair. With callous fingers she braided it, then hid it behind my ear. You are Barsalai. Barsalai, tiger-striped. Silently, I moved my mouth to form the word. My name, Barsalai. Truth be told, I was afraid I'd be needle-nose as an adult. This new name settled on my shoulders like a well-worn cloak. Ah, that was right, my project. I presented my mother with a bundle of cloth. Slowly, deliberately, she unfolded it. Within was a deal lined with tiger fur. I will not lie and say it was of exquisite make. Embroidery has never been my strong suit. But it was warm and made of sturdy cloth, and the colors were pleasing to the eye. If it was plain, the tiger fur made up for it. My mother's lips widened into a smile. I saw a rare sight that night. Wrinkles around her mouth and eyes. She covered my head with her hand and kissed my cheek. Bagheera erupted into cheers. Uncle Ganzerig spilled his kumak onto the fire. It exploded upward. Suddenly I was afloat in a sea of people clapping me on the shoulder or pinching my cheeks or sniffing me. More than one of my cousins dragged me closer to the fire. In the frantic steps of Khorne dances, we lost ourselves. Your parents did their best imitation of us. I'm embarrassed to say that Oitski managed a perfect impression despite going through the whole thing without a word. At one point, your mother almost fell into the campfire, only for your father to swoop her away at the last moment. Oshizuru laughed and kissed him. But their joy did not extend to you. I can count on one hand the number of times I've been upset with you, Shizuka. That night, acid filled my throat. That night, a foul anger clouded an otherwise wonderful celebration. Every time I saw you, the taste in my mouth grew more bitter, and I was not the only one to notice. Your friend, Otgar whispered to me, is she always like this? I shook my head. I don't know why we ever let you stay with the Hokarans, Otgar said. No sense for a good party. She was a far better dancer than I was. 4 more years of experience did that. I struggled to keep up with her steps and hoped all the kumak in my belly wouldn't topple me over into the fire. Whenever I took a false step, Otgar caught me. If I fell, it was mostly her responsibility, but I like to think she didn't want me to hurt myself. During one such false step, I fell backwards and landed on my bottom. A chorus of laughs followed. My relatives teased me for having more kumak than I can handle. Otgar helped me up, just as a gust of wind flickered the fire. Hardened warriors spat on the ground. Superstition. Winds were not meant to enter the gare, for they brought with them the foul spirits that haunted the steps at night. I spat on the ground, too. But I also saw the tail of your dress as you left through the red door. My chest burned, my stomach churned. The speech I wanted to give you formed in my mind. I got to my feet, told Otgar I'd return soon, and followed you out. Outside, spring winds cut through my Hokarn clothing. I wished I'd brought my deal. I'd be warm in my deal, and I could have smuggled some kumak out. But no, I wore the clothing you bought me. Earlier this morning, it made me feel braver. Now I just felt cold. Wordlessly, I followed you. At some point, you'd stop. At some time, the cold would get to you, or the faint smell of horse manure, or one of the animals would startle you. But no. You kept walking, and by the time you stopped, I'd been following you for what felt like an hour. You have a party to attend, do you not? You sneered. A puff of vapor left my nostrils, the tips of my ears fast turned red. I scowled at you and dug in my heels. You hid your hands within your sleeves. The moon cast her silver light onto you and lent an unearthly air to your complexion. In that moment, I saw some traces of the woman you'd become. I saw your sharp lips painted red as your sword. I saw your cheeks pink as petals. I saw the brown gold of your cutting eyes. And I saw the 8-year-old girl shaking in the freezing cold. Despite the fire of anger in me, I could not just stand there and watch you freeze. I walked up to you and wrapped an arm around you. You're leaving in the morning, aren't you? I nodded. Another puff of vapor left my lips and spiraled into the air between us. You looked out at the pure white gears alight from within, looked out at the horses and the dogs and the guards. I will see you again, you said. I know I will. But until that time, you will keep yourself safe. I know there are no tigers on the steps. Do not go chasing anything large and fanged and terrible. You aren't allowed to get hurt until I see you again. You just aren't. You leaned your head on my shoulder as you spoke. I tried very hard to hold on to my anger, but it was like holding water, only my fingers were still wet. Celebrate, I said. You scoffed. Celebrate your leaving. You shook your head. No, I will not celebrate that. Ah, there it was again. A bit more water in my palms. My name, Barcelai. You paused. You took my hand and hid it in your flower-scented sleeves. I was struck by how small your wrists were. Then I will not celebrate your going, Barcelai, but we will celebrate in the halls of Vegina when you return. And I will call you Shefali, and you will call me Shizuka, even when we are adults. And I said nothing, lest my voice ruin the beauty of the moment. Because we were together beneath the great silver moon, together on the steps, and I did not know when I would next be near you. Write to me, he said. I did. Over the next 3 years, I wrote to you whenever I had the chance. I did not have the chance often. Paper was too delicate to last long traveling with us. Corn favored oral messages when possible. But every now and again, we would meet a merchant on his way to Sorshar, and I would buy as much paper as I could and have Otgard write to you. When our travels took us to the great mountain Gurkhan-Khalsar, I secretly cut a few mountain flowers and sent them to you. That night I prayed to Grandfather Earth to forgive me for what I'd done, but I cannot say I truly regretted it. You, who had an entire imperial garden delivered from Fujina to Oshiro simply so I could see, certainly you deserve something sacred in return. I did not tell you in that letter what Gurkhan-Khalsar means to us. You see, it is the highest point on the steps. In front of it runs the river Rokan, which flows from the harsh tundra of the north all the way down to the golden sands. As such, at the peak of Gurkhan-Khalsar, you are closest to Grandmother Sky, and at its base, you are very near the waters given to us by Grandfather Earth. On Gurkhan-Khalsar alone do you find this perfect union. So it is that Karsas and Karsaks climb the mountain once a year to meditate. Only there at the peak will they hear the whispers of the future. So the story goes. And while my mother was busy meditating, I chose to pluck a livid flower from the earth and tuck it away within my deal. I did this knowing some of my ancestors are buried on this mountain. I did this knowing my mother would have slain anyone who dared to alter Gurkhan-Khalsar in any way. I did it because I thought you deserved it. I hope the flower arrived intact. In your return letter, you wrote that it was still fragrant when it arrived. What did you think when you held it in your hands, this sacred object? If I had stolen a prayer tag from a temple and sent it to you, it would have been less sacrilegious. When you pressed it to your nose, what did you smell? For my people believe the soul of a person is in their scent, in their hair. On the mountain, there are dozens of banners made from the mane of Karsaks and Karsas and their horses. The wind whips through them and carries their souls forever across the great plains. One day, I will take you to the mountain, and you shall see them all lined up, all swaying like dancers, and you will think of the flower I gave you when we were children. Winter loneliness in a mountain village. I wrote to you of all the things I saw, the places I'd traveled. There weren't many, at least not many different ones. The steps enthrall me, Shizuka, and they always have. but there are only so many times I can write about endless silver grass before it gets boring. I wrote about it anyway. Anything I could think of, how Otgar's new bows were coming along, a long rant about where a saddle should sit on a horse's back, my Uncle Ganzerik's latest stew recipe went into those letters. Otgar hated transcribing them. She must have gotten used to it, though, since we did it every day for 2 years straight. 720 letters. When I was writing them, they all felt like one long conversation. Your replies always found us within a reasonable span. My mother enlisted 4 messengers dedicated only to our correspondence until we reached the northern forests. The Corin there almost looked like Hokarans. Their skin was so pale, but their hair was lighter than mine was, and they still greeted us with kumak and old war songs. The chief of the northern tribe was, at the time, a man named Sirin Kalan. Old and gray, with as many scars as a dappled mare has spots, he greeted us from horseback. Only 3 pale braids circled his head, tied from the hair at the base of his crown. Across the flat of his bald head was a nasty streak of scarred flesh. We shared his fire that first night, and stayed in his care for the customary meal. On the first night of my mother's visits, she did not discuss business. Instead, Sirin Kalan spoke to us of his daughters and his sons, of marriages and funerals. I listened, though I knew none of the people being discussed. Otgar translated for my mother and gave me summaries of the people. I had distant cousins here, too, thanks to my absurd number of aunts. But the reason I remember this night so well, the reason I can still picture old Sirin Kalan poking at the fire, the reason I can feel the tip of my nose go numb when I think about that night, is what happened after we left our own gare. I saw something out of the corner of my eye, dashing between the gares. Tall, slender, cloaked in black and red, it moved as quickly as a shadow flickering between trees. Wolves sometimes attacked us, but they would not do this so far north, and they would not get so close to the camps when they know we'd shoot them on sight. Nor could I say the figure looked Corn. It did not wear a deal or any winter clothing at all. I froze in place. My mother turned toward me, one hand on the hilt of her scimitar. She wrinkled her nose and bared her teeth. I pointed where I'd seen the figure, and my mother made a few more gestures. "Search the area," Otgar said. The riders scrambled off. I watched them go, opening and closing my fists. I had the sinking feeling they were not going to find anything. What if this, like the glimmer near the dying, was something only I could see? I strung my bow and pulled an arrow from my quiver. "Shefali," Otgar said. "What are you doing?" I started walking between the gares. That thing was somewhere around here, lurking near my people, and I would not allow it to continue stalking us. "Has it occurred to you," Otgar said, "that you are 10 years old?" I continued, no use arguing, I did not have the time. "Black and red, black and red, there, I saw it. Her, clearly now, a living darkness against a pure white gare." I drew back my bow and aimed. "What are you firing at?" Otgar asked. I was right. She couldn't see the dark thing. More reason to let fly. Except, well, there were people in that gare, and if my arrow pierced through its walls, they might be hurt. A moment's hesitation doomed me, because the figure noticed that I noticed her. It is difficult to say that a shadow smiled. If you imagine a silhouette in the darkest ink against finest paper, that was the figure I saw. No features, no light, nothing to indicate she had any expression at all. Yet, I knew she was looking at me, and my bones rattled with her amusement. "Hello, Steel Eye." Ice ran through my veins. Who was Steel Eye? For I'd earned my name already. Tiger-striped I was, with my mother's viper-green eyes. And yet in my chest I felt a rightness. That, more than the voice itself, terrified me. I wanted to run. I wanted more than anything to run. But I was Barsalai Shefali now, an adult in the Burkila clan, and the Burkila clan did not become dominant by running from their enemies. So I thought at this thing clearly and loudly. "Whatever you are, you are not welcome in my lands." "They are not your lands yet, Steel Eye," she said. "And you are still a child. You cannot stop me." "I can," I thought. Again I raised my bow. Atgarsh squeezed my forearm, her face wrought with concern. "Sheikh Ali," she said, "there's nothing there. You're staring at a blank patch of the gare." Laughter, if you could call it that, the sound of a lump of coal shattering. See how they doubt you. So they will for years and years. It would be much easier if you joined us now, it said. Its words triggered a roiling anger within me. I no longer cared if anyone was hurt. I fired. The shadow peeled away from the gare. Arrow met felt. The sound of breaking coal rang through the air. The figure slipped inside. I took a step forward. Atgar blocked my path. "Sheikh Ali," she said in a level voice, "listen to me. Whatever you saw, don't let it affect you like this. You are going to be Karsa one day. You cannot let the shadows rule you." By then my mother returned with empty-handed riders. She saw the arrow sticking out from the gare, saw it was mine, and frowned. When she sharply gestured that I should apologize to the inhabitants, I was not surprised. I looked to her from Atgar. My cousin was 14 then. In a few more years, she'd be ready to marry. She was not a pretty girl, but she was smart as a whip. Someone would be coming to stay with her soon, some boy working off his bride price. And she was looking at me like I was a child who ran off from camp and nearly got eaten by wolves. I lowered my bow and shrank about 3 sizes. I knew what I saw, and I knew it had a name, the same way I knew your name from the moment I could speak. Shell. Her name was Shell. My mother forced me to apologize, and I did that as curtly as I could. A small family lived inside that gare. A man, his wife, his grandmother. Very small. No doubt the man's brothers died off before my mother came to power during the wars. So many of us died to the black blood that we were trying to make up for it. Each family was encouraged to have as many children as they could, and then Senvartans got involved. "Did you know, Shizuka, that many of the Korin children you see these days are fatherless? Given the proper rituals, Senvartans can induce pregnancy. But still I saw no children here." Atgar did her best to calm me. She told me the story of Tuimbayar again, the Karsa who used the moon as her bow, with hair of shining silver and skin like rich clay. That night I listened to another of Atgar's stories and pretended to take an interest in it. Tuimbayar saddled her golden mare and rode to the north. Friendly winds told her of a clan in danger there. When she arrived, she found demons rampaging through the camp, scooping up horses and snapping into them like jerky, dozens of them, the largest horde anyone had ever seen up to that point, and this was ages ago, when demons did not roam the countryside as they do now. An entire clan could not hope to defeat this many. But Tuimbayar and her golden mare were worth 20 clans together, so she strung her crescent moon bow and fired her windcutter arrows. As she fired at the beasts, she rode in a circle around them, faster and faster each time. The demons caught on to this and threw people at her, threw horses at her, threw anything they could to try to slow her down. Tuimbayar reached into her 1,000-pocket saddlebags. She pulled out her skin of mare's milk, and with the tip of her arrow, she slit it open. Milk dripped along her path. Tuimbayar, raised by a cadre of Senvartan, spoke holy words as she rode. Demons charged at her, but could not pass the barrier of milk. Tuimbayar rode just outside their grasp. In an hour's time, no more, she felled all the demons. When they were dead, she herself set fire to their bodies so that their foul blood could not corrupt Grandfather Earth. She did this wearing the deal given to her by Grandmother Sky herself, which protected her from all manner of harm. It was a good story. Not the best Tuimbayar story, but good. Enough to get my mind off things, if it were any other night or any other thing I'd seen. Atgar did her best to lend the tale more weight. "One day, you shall hear her Tuimbayar voice, and you will laugh loud and long." Tuimbayar is something like your ancestor Shiori to us. I've heard 1,000 stories about her. Despite my better judgment, I believe every one. For who's to say whether or not Tuimbayar really did fire arrows of wind, or if the ridge of the mountains north of the Rokan really are her horse's footprints? These things are legends, in their own way, all legends are true. You must be laughing now. I'm certain you've heard a few legends about us. Those are true as well, but true in a different way. I've begun to think about the Barsalai my clan whispers about as a different person. Did you know, Shizuka, I've heard children telling Tumenbayar stories, but with me instead of her. Sometime after midnight, Otgar gave in to sleep. I stayed up a while later. If Xiao returned, I wanted to be ready. This time I told myself I would not hesitate. So I told myself. In reality, we'd been riding most of the day, and most of the day before that. Exhaustion gripped me, and try as I might, I could not fight it. I too fell asleep. I awoke to women screaming,
"Berkila, Berkila, save us!"
As I scrambled to my feet, my mother was dashing out our door with sword in hand. Ringing pain split my ears. I reached for my bow and followed her out. My chest ached. Without looking, I knew which gare we'd be going to, the one I saw Xiao outside of. A dozen Koran clustered outside its red door, color drained from dark faces. An old grandmother sank to her knees in the snow, weeping, raking her cheeks and pulling her hair. She was the one screaming for my mother. Alshara pushed her way to the door, then pushed her way past that. I saw her go in and I tried to follow, only to find crossed swords barring my path. "Barsalai," said the taller woman, "a demon visited us last night. That gare's no place for a child." I pointed to my braid, my one braid. The woman I was speaking to had three. "Braid or no, name or no," she said, "you are 10. I cannot let you pass." I knew this woman, though not by name. She rode in my mother's personal guards. Short for a Koran, she had short hair the color of hay and a scar on her chin. On her left hand, she was missing one finger. Years she'd been with us. I remember seeing her when I still had to be strapped into my horse. A good, loyal guard is hard to find. At that moment, I wish she were a bit less loyal. I could not strike her down. I was not you. I could not command her. I was not even Otgar. Where was Otgar? Bounding up toward the gare, hastily fastening her deal with one hand and holding her hat to her head with the other, the guard looked to her and crossed her arms. "Dorbente, until I receive orders otherwise, I cannot allow you to enter." "Who is going to give you the orders?" Otgar said. "Berkila? She is not going to break her oath of silence to speak to you." The guard pressed her lips into a line. "Dorbente, the body might be corrupt." "Berkila does not fear corruption, and neither do I," said Otgar. "I do not intend to touch the corpse. We will be fine." But I did not want to wait for her to negotiate. While Otgar spoke to the guard, I slipped in. My mother stood at the western side of the gare, at her feet, a corpse. Calling it a corpse is perhaps exaggerating. You were out in your imperial garden enjoying a plum. Suddenly business calls you away. You leave the plum on a bench and tend to your affairs. Hours later, when you return home, the plum is forgotten. Days pass into weeks. When you next sit on the bench, the plum is still there, but it is a dry, withered thing, and you mistake it for a stone. So it was with the corpse. Once it might have been a man. Now it was simply skin and bones, no meat, no substance. On its face, an eternal scream. Dark pits where its eyes should have been. Dark pits for nostrils. Any hair the man had was gone too, as well as any clothing. Worst of all, I saw no glimmering near him. My stomach churned. I tasted bile at the back of my throat. A Karsa cannot retch at the sight of a body. I tried my best to conceal it. Still, I let out a small noise. My mother sheathed her sword. She stomped on the ground once to catch my attention. When she saw I looked at her, she pointed to the corpse, then the door. I nodded and left and tried not to think of the shadow I'd seen the night before. When I left the gare, Otgar and the guard were still talking. Both turned toward me. "Barsalai," said the guard, "I told you not to go in there." The old woman continued her wailing, her screaming. "Berkila, save us." Over and over again, as if my mother could bring her dead son back to life. I screwed my eyes shut against the sound and waved for Otgar to come closer.
"Burn the body," I whispered to her. "Remove it. Burn it."
Otgar nodded. Orders were passed along. I did not stay to watch it all happen. No need to. Instead, I followed my mother and Otgar as they made their way to Sirin Kalan's gare. The old man was already awake. My mother did not bother taking off her boots, and so neither did we. As he bowed to us, the old chief shook. My mother made three sharp gestures.
"Sirin Kalan," said Otgar, "how long has this been happening?"
The man's gare was empty. Completely empty. I cannot remember another time I've seen something like it. Stark white felt walls, with no furniture to speak of save the door and the frame keeping everything up. After seeing the corpse of that man from earlier, I shivered. Something was very wrong with this clan.
"Great Karsa," said Sirin Kalan, tapping his forehead against my mother's boots.
"Wallbreaker, slayer of men, Burkila Alshara, I am unworthy to be in your presence."
Otgar rolled her eyes. My mother tapped her lips, then held her fingers out.
"Get to the point," Otgar said. The old man took fistfuls of the rug at his feet. Shaking, he looked up at my mother. Did he see a woman, I wonder, or a legend? Did he see the uncrowned Karsa, the woman who breathed dragon's fire? Or did he see something darker, perhaps a woman who killed her own brothers rather than submit to their authority? For my mother was all those things and more, and sometimes I had trouble figuring out which woman I spoke to. But from his eyes wide as pebbles and his cheeks paler than the walls of the gare, I had an idea what he saw. The destroyer.
"Burkila," he said with a trembling voice, "I fear the generals have come for my clan."
"Don't be silly," Otgar said. My mother's hands were still. This was Otgard's opinion alone.
"Of the six remaining clans, yours is the smallest. One of the generals would never bother coming all the way up north unless they wanted a fine fur coat. We cannot be dealing with a general."
I nodded. The generals, four demon lords in the service of the traitor, made appearances only in the most dire of times. When armies of black bloods marched, a general led them. When the traitor's forces tore through Ochishaki as an arrow through paper, the generals strung their bows. But for a few hundred corn up near the mountains, barely scraping by on whatever food they could scavenge, it made no sense. What would a general want with his clan? Not to mention, the remaining three were trapped beyond the Wall of Flowers. Everyone knew that. The daughter's creation kept them from rampaging through the rest of Shishaki province, kept them sealed within the borders of northern Hokkaido. The last time actual demons set foot on the steps was when Tumenbayar was Grand Karsa. Black Bloods would not be surprising, but Black Bloods did not leave this sort of mess. They left carnage, blood and broken bones, not empty husks. If demons were out on the steps again... My mother's fingers moved in soft, small gestures, meant for Otgar, not Sirin Kalan. I did not catch all of them, but I understood enough. "We will make a diplomat out of you yet."
"What else could this do to a man? To many men?" Sirin Kalan protested.
As he continued, his voice cracked like a child's. I felt a pang of pity for him, for my people. There were not many of us left, less than the population of even a small Hokkaran city. Every life lost was notable now.
"A demon," Otgar said. "But it's not a general. There are only four of those, old man, and Burkila killed one with Nasirin. We would have seen it by now if it were a black blood, too. They're not good at hiding. So it must be a demon. It cannot be a black blood."
"A demon," said Sirin Kalan. He attempted to get to his feet.
My mother tapped her foot and he stayed where he was.
"How could they get past the Wall of Flowers? Demons are a rice tongue problem, not one of ours."
Moving shadows against the gare's walls, a featureless face smiling at me.
"Not for long," I said.
Otgar and Alshara both shot me a look. I shifted my weight from one foot to the other. Curiosity written on my mother's features. Who taught me anything about demons? I licked my lips. My mother is silent because of an oath. but I simply don't like talking. More to the point, I had no idea where that bit of information had come from. Do flowers know, I wonder, when it's going to rain?